Have I, like, stepped over some line in the sands of coolness with you? Because, excuse me if somebody doesn't know the secret handshake with you.
There's no secret handshake. There's an IQ prerequisite, but there's no secret handshake.
A young woman, unsure of what she wants to do with her life after graduating college, finds herself in a complicated love triangle. This week, special guest Sue Winter from the Go Inform podcast joins us to discuss Carmen Sandiego in space, when smoking in movies hit its peak, and the dangers of reading whatever's on the cue cards. Then we find out if Reality Bites stands the test of time.
James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glut. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Test of Time. I'm James Brief, and joining me, as always, is my podcast partner, the director of this show, Alan Noah.
Aw, thank you. You are too kind. And joining both of us once again is Sue Winter, a.k.a. Maven, from the Go Informed podcast. Welcome back, Sue.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be back on this show. I am a big fan, you know.
Well, thank you. And I am a huge fan of your show. So it's a mutual admiration society, as they say, someone has said, people have said at some point, I assume. We had you on last week to talk about Singles, which was a movie set in Seattle, which is your hometown. And today we're talking about Reality Bites, which is a movie set in Houston. And the common thread is that they're both sort of considered these iconic Gen X movies. And you consider yourself Gen X, is that right, Sue?
Oh, yeah. You can definitely count me as Gen X.
Now, it's interesting because James and I are, depending on the definition, either Gen X or millennial or neither.
But we don't fit into either of them. That's the problem.
Yeah, and I feel like I had read at some point that Gen X ended in 78 and millennials started in like 80 or 81 or 82. And, you know, James and I are born in 1979. So there was this like couple year gap that was nothing. And now since like if you look it up, which I did today, like Gen X goes to 80. But there are these people who say that like in that narrow gap, like 78 to 82, give or take, we are either the lost generation or the Xennials, like a cross between X and millennials, which I don't know how you would say it.
I heard a good one recently. I heard that we are Generation Oregon Trail because everyone in our generation would have played that computer game in elementary school.
I never played Oregon Trail. Did you, Sue?
No, that was way past my time.
That was the, like in the computer room in your elementary school or something. That would be the one game. That or Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? Those were the two games that you could play.
I played a lot of Carmen Sandiego. Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? Where in the U.S. is Carmen Sandiego? Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego? I played all of the Carmen Sandiegos.
Guess which one I have, Al. Just guess. Knowing me, I have a very rare one. And it's one that people don't know. Guess what it is, Al.
Where in Space is Carmen Sandiego?
That's correct.
What?
That's the stupidest thing in the world. Why would she go to space?
What the, she's an international, an intergalactic, thief. I guess she's a thief, right? That's who she is.
Yeah. But like, I think there are different stereotypes for the different generations, and I haven't wanted to be a millennial or a Gen Xer, which I guess is kind of stupid because it probably means about as much as your astrological sign. Like, you can't like make an overgeneralization about so many people, but like as an official Gen Xer, what does it mean to you, Sue?
Well, I personally think that the defining thing of Gen X is the 80s. So I think that if you were in high school or in college in the 80s, then you are Gen X. You know, I think that the baby boomers that came before us, they were like 60s and maybe early 70s for high school and college. And then the millennials were 90s around then for high school. When you define a generation, usually it's defined by their youth. And not when they were five, but when they were 16, you know. And I really think that being in high school in the 80s and kind of coming of age during the Reagan years definitely defined Generation X.
You know, you mentioned something last week that I was thinking about a lot this week, and it especially came up with Reality Bites a good bit. Last week, we reviewed the movie Singles from 1991. They have a flashback to college in the 80s, and I never really thought about it much, but I guess college was defined by the rise of HIV and AIDS. And there's this line that last week one of the characters was saying, oh, I thought I'd go to college and I'd have all this sex and free love, but I went to college a decade too late.
Yeah. I mean, definitely AIDS and HIV was a big deal at that time. And it affected kids because, you know, how it was transmitted. It was definitely a scary time. I mean, I lost someone in my family to AIDS in the 80s, and, you know, we didn't talk about it. It was different, way different back then.
Oh, my God. So sorry.
Yeah, me too. The same thing in my family. Mm-hmm. As a pediatrician, when I have, like, the sex talk with my adolescent patients, they are most worried about pregnancy. That is what defines them with safe sex. And mm-hmm. they'll consider, oh, yeah, but we're safe. She's on the pill. And I go, you're safe from exactly one thing. And like, it's not a disease.
Yeah, well, you know, back in those days, there wasn't any treatment. And you saw how awful it was for people who got AIDS. And so it really was scary. And now, you know, you see people living with HIV have lived for decades with it. It just has a different impact. Obviously, no one would want to get it even now. But boy, it was super scary back then.
Yeah. And, you know, when we think of our college years, we graduated in 2001. So, I mean, we literally graduated in June of 2001, you know, 3 months before the world changed in September of 2001. Mm-hmm. So in retrospect, our generation, our 90s generation, was pretty peaceful and prosperous. And I guess we just didn't realize how good we had it. And our generation, our little micro generation, was, you know, didn't have this, you know, this huge defining moment. But Al and I, we had it pretty easy if you think about it.
Definitely, definitely. And I think there's some like level of, I don't know if resentment's the right word, but like definitely in the movie Reality Bites, like you feel that the Gen X generation has this resentment towards the generation before. I mean, that's basically like the opening of the movie. And sometimes it's this weird thing where like, you know, it has to be like the boomers versus the Xers or the Xers versus the millennials. And I don't know, like, I kind of think that's sort of dumb to fight about like these things of like, well, you had it worse because you had this and I had it better because of that. And ultimately, like, everyone's got their own stuff. But I think that even more than Singles, Reality Bites is really sort of like planting a flag of like, this is Gen X and this is our story and this is our struggle. And, you know, I was reading some interviews today where Ben Stiller, who directed it, and the woman who wrote the script were saying, you know, like, it wasn't really meant to be that. It was just sort of like a story about, you know, these characters. But certainly, like, in the marketing and the way it's perceived, it has sort of become the symbol of Gen X, for good or bad.
Yeah, I guess with that, let's talk about this film. Reality Bites is a movie about a group of recent college graduates who find themselves aimless in their careers and their love lives. Leilana, she's an aspiring documentarian. Vicky, she works retail and engages in countless one-night stands. Sammy, he's gay but hesitant to come out to his parents. And Troy is an aspiring rocker who can't hold a job. And Lilena, she starts dating Michael, a young executive, and finds herself torn between him and Troy. She begins to question her priorities, her goals, and who she wants to be with. And, you know, looking at the box office, this film opened up a couple years after Singles. It opened in February 18th, 1994. It had an $11.5 million budget, so around the same budget as Singles. And it opened at number 5 with $6 million, on its way to $20.9 million and $33 million worldwide. This film, just like Singles, it had another thing in common, that the soundtrack was way more popular than the film. This soundtrack also went platinum. This was the song that was actually a late addition, apparently, just because the singer was like a personal friend of Ethan Hawke, and she got this song on the soundtrack at the last minute. I'm sure you've heard this one. This is Stay by Lisa Loeb. I think it's credited as Lisa Loeb and Nine Stories. You said you called me because you want me, and one day you let me go. You try to give away, keep her, or keep me because you know you're just so scared.
Stay was everywhere. I mean, that song was all over the radio. The Baby I Love Your Way cover by Big Mountain also got a lot of radio airplay.
Story of My Life, that was a big song too.
Right. And I mean, it was a big soundtrack, but decidedly not grunge like the single soundtrack. There's Dinosaur Jr. on there, but you know, I think that's about as close to grunge as you get.
Mm-hmm. But this film has a lot of camcorder footage, and it opens up on camcorder footage of a college graduation.
Sue, did you have a giant camcorder like that back in the day?
You know I did. I was the one that had that camcorder with me at every party. I mean, good thing we can't see those tapes now, because my friend's kids, we really wouldn't want to see it.
I was that guy in our group. Al, you remember, my dad's camcorder. I used to carry it around. And this was not one of those camcorders that you had the little screen. You actually had to look through the eyepiece.
Yeah.
And it was hard to do, but it was a lot of fun.
It was super fun.
Yeah. And Lilena is played by Winona Ryder. She is the valedictorian of what you can imagine is a prestigious school. And she's giving a speech. And, you know, the one thing we have to know about winning in life is, and she actually can't find the correct cue card. And she just goes, I don't know. And everyone actually starts cheering because they actually really like that answer, even though she, you know, had to make that up on the spot.
I was wondering, like, what did she have on that card? What was the end to that? I sort of was thinking that, like, maybe at some point the movie was going to go back to that. And one other character was going to say, you know, I always wanted to ask, how were you going to finish that speech? And they don't. But like after the graduation, they're having like this celebration on the rooftop, and there were so many Test of Time references in that one scene. I was trying to jot them all down. At one point, Janine Garofalo's character references the Columbia Record and Tape Club.
Yeah.
Ethan Hawke's character says he'd like to buy the world a Coke, which is referencing that old commercial. It might be Janine Garofalo again, who says she has a not-so-fresh feeling, which is a reference to, I don't even remember the
name
of the brand.
Some deodorant.
No, I think it was like a feminine hygiene product.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe so. Summer's Eve or something.
Right.
Yeah. And they start singing Conjunction Junction from Schoolhouse Rock. And I have seen zero episodes of Schoolhouse Rock. Like, these characters, they're graduating college in 1994, I guess. So that would make them born in 71.
No, they're probably graduating in 91 or so, because this takes place a couple years later.
Okay. Even still, they're like 8 to 10 years older than me and you, James, like some of these references were just like, some of them I got, some of them were like, okay, I guess I know what Schoolhouse Rock is, but that just wasn't like an important thing in my childhood. Was that a show that you connected with a lot to?
Yeah, yeah, that was right on. Actually, they nailed that. All those references to TV, especially like you see it throughout the movie where they have the Brady Bunch or whatever. That is what Gen X grew up on. We were the first generation that our moms all were at work and we would go home after school and just watch TV. And that was our babysitter when we were 12 years old. And so we watched all that kind of stuff and the Conjunction Junction, that Schoolhouse Rock was Saturday morning TV when I was like 8-10 years old. That actually does time out right. That one, I give a thumbs up.
And something that this film seems to reference is that, and maybe they exaggerate because it seems like everyone's parents are divorced, but they seem to really reference that this is a generation that is raised in a divorced household, you know, which is, you know, not inaccurate, but it's definitely making several references to the new parent and the stepmom who's younger and, that whole trope.
That dinner scene after the graduation with Leilana's mom and stepdad and dad and stepmom, and it's horrifically awkward and miserable. I mean, that I think sort of transcends generations. I mean, I have been in that situation with my mom and stepdad and dad and stepmom, and it is just the worst. Everyone's trying to get along. But there's like the looks and the glances and the things that are said that you just want people to let slide and they can't let slide. And I mean, anyone with divorced parents, I would think, could relate to that.
Yeah. I like that this film kind of quickly sets up, and I think it does a good job of introducing the characters and like who they are. They're educated, but they're all kind of working pretty menial jobs at I guess they're supposed to be like 23, 24. You've got Vicky, Janine Garofalo's character. She's working at the Gap. And you have Troy, played by Ethan Hawke, and he seems to have had like a dozen jobs, even though they reference that he has 180 IQ. And he's always reading these intellectual books, so he's kind of an overqualified guy for any of the jobs that he can't seem to keep. And you have Lelena, she's played by Winona Ryder, and she works on the set of like a Good Morning Houston kind of show. And just seeing her with the headset on, I instantly knew, I'm like, oh, she's like the associate producer or the production assistant, one of those.
Yeah, production assistant. She's pretty low on the totem pole there. And at first, when the host, Grant, played by John Mahoney, who's always great, he's reading off of cue cards, and I was going to make some test of time comment about teleprompters, but teleprompters existed in the early 90s, I think. Pretty sure. But even still, like, Grant seems like he's an old school guy who would only use index cards. And that is totally believable to me that that happened in 94. I'm sure there are TV hosts that still do that today. Later on, you know, she messes with him by writing inappropriate things on the cards and he just reads them. And to be fair, having worked in television for a long time, that will happen. There are people who will read anything that is in front of them and maybe catch it right after, or maybe not.
Well, there was a throwaway line where Lelena, she gives him like 4 or 5 pages of notes and is like, look, you want to read up on this guest? And he's like, whatever, I'm going to wing it. And the guy who doesn't do his research and he's going to wing it, he is going to read word for word what's on the card. So I thought it was his own fault.
Well, yeah, and I can relate to that too. I definitely remember moments where I've like worked very hard to put together a packet of information for a television personality who I will not name. And then they were like, and you could see them just kind of put it down next to them in the dressing room, never to be picked up or looked at or anything. That happens. She makes a comment about him where she says that he's so cheesy she can't watch without crackers, which I thought was like kind of funny, but also in and of itself, a pretty cheesy line.
No,
she's making fun of him for being cheesy, but that gag was pretty cheesy.
Yeah. We quickly meet this character, Michael, who's played by Ben Stiller, as you mentioned now, who also directed the film. I didn't know that before I turned this film on.
His directorial debut.
Yeah. He is driving. We quickly establish that this guy is, you know, he's a yuppie. Because what's the one thing that every single person in the world has today, but not necessarily an asshole, but you're kind of associated with a rich asshole if it was in a film? What is it, Al?
A car phone?
Yeah, exactly. So he's a guy speaking on a car phone, and he gets distracted, and he crashes into Lilena's car. And strangely, he's like, my lawyer's telling me I have to sue you. And I'm like, sue her? Like, this is totally your fault, dude.
No, she threw a lit cigarette into his car.
That is true. Yeah, it is her fault. I guess so. But he did crash into her. But you're right, Al. You're right.
Could we mention how much smoking is in this movie? Talk about a test of time thing. It's like, we're all adults. You can tell because of all the smoking.
You know, in a weird way, Al and I have reviewed films in the 70s and 80s, and there's tons of smoking. And, you know, then you do films in the 90s, and there's, you know, 90s and certainly 2000s, there's no smoking. And we kind of wonder, when did this hit its peak? I think I can declare now, it's Reality Bites. Reality Bites is the last film that you saw. And it wasn't referenced like, oh, this is so bad, smoking the cigarettes. No, it was a part of their lives, and it is completely indoors. It's ashtrays everywhere. I'm going to call it. It's Reality Bites. It's the last young person film where everyone's smoking, and they don't even really mention that they're smoking.
I did read an interview today with Ben Stiller. I think it was on like the movie's 20th or 25th anniversary or something, where he said that he feels bad about the glorification of smoking in this movie. He's like, I didn't think about it at the time when we were making the movie, but looking at it now, oh my God, there's so much cigarettes in hands, cigarettes in mouths, close-up shots of cigarettes. And yeah, it is definitely noticeable. And Michael, who's played by Ben Stiller, he works for In Your Face TV, which is basically supposed to be MTV. And they say it's like MTV, but with an edge. And it's fine to rag on MTV. I say that as a guy who worked there. But Ben Stiller is lampooning MTV, and that's sort of where he got his big break, the Ben Stiller Show, which led to him getting this movie and led to a lot of other things in his career. So you could say that maybe he should have been a little nicer to MTV. I mean, considering he like kind of helped shape the creative direction of this movie, but also his show was on MTV for a little while and then got canceled. So maybe he was kind of bitter about that. I don't know.
It reminded me of that that short-lived network Fuse. It was supposed to be like MTV, but, you know, not as lame as MTV with all their reality shows. Back to the music. And, you know, that didn't last either.
Well, I worked for Fuse for a couple of years. And
I remember.
Fuse's whole thing was it's really music television, like with the focus on actual music. But speaking of music, I do just want to point out that Troy's band in this movie is called Hey, That's My Bike. And we got a good laugh at Citizen Dick last week in the singles episode. And Citizen Dick is a pretty funny name for a fake band, but I gotta give it to this movie and in this category. Hey, That's My Bike is a phenomenal name for a fake band. I think that's hilarious.
I swear there was an actual band with that name back in the day. My husband and I just looked at each other and were like, wait a minute, wasn't there a band really called Hey, That's My Bike? Because I swear I saw their thing stuck up on the telephone pole. And now I'm wondering, like, was it just a thing for this movie? I don't know.
Maybe someone really just lost their bike and they were just placing an ad for it.
Well, that could be.
You know, I have to say that in 1994, the only time I wore a suit is when my dad would make me wear a suit, a bar mitzvah or, you know, some formal occasion. But I have to ask you, were all men wearing extra large suits in the mid-90s, like early mid-90s? Because we've seen films like this before. Ben Affleck in the film Mallrats, he's wearing these huge suits. And Ben Stiller's suits are all too big on him.
They're huge. But that really was the look. It was that Armani and Hugo Boss look, and it was these big like shoulder pads and the pleated pants, and Yeah, his look, it cracked me up.
It looks ridiculous to me today, but I keep seeing it in these films. But he instantly likes Elena and he asks her out on a date. And when he shows up at their apartment, and it seems like almost all of them seem to sort of live together. And Michael shows up wearing one of these 90s suits. And Troy, Ethan Hawke, goes, are you a collection agent? And I think he knows he's not, but it's a great insult to the guy.
Yeah, I mean, the movie very quickly establishes this love triangle, and right away you can tell that Troy and Leilani like each other, but they're not together, and it's this sort of will they, won't they kind of thing. And Michael basically represents everything that Troy isn't. You know, Michael has a job and a good job, and Troy is, you know, in a band and keeps getting fired. And Michael is on their date talking about like how he doesn't want to come across as materialistic, that, you know, he doesn't only care about cars and a house and nice and fancy things, but clearly that is kind of important to him. And it sort of represents this movie's, I don't know, I guess kind of like thesis about like, do you sell out? Is money everything? You know, when do you work for money? When do you not? And it's interesting seeing the contrast between Michael and Troy, but then you really see it with Michael and Leilani, like as they're talking and she's going on about the greatest invention in the history of the world is the Big Gulp, you know? And like hearing Michael sort of be like, what are you talking about? You know, like that's kind of foreign to him. And even though they're all Gen X, like Michael's maybe supposed to be 5-10 years older. And so he's just a little bit farther along in life. And so he has a very different outlook. And I think that's interesting because, you know, like I was saying before, these characters are only 5-10 years older than me. And I can't relate to like the whole Schoolhouse Rock thing. Like even when you're within the same generation, there's just these very different outlooks on life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a lot of Big Gulps too.
A lot of them. And yeah. I have to assume that Lelena is only drinking Diet Cokes because she looks like she's under 100 pounds in this film.
Right.
And and Vicky, Janine Garofalo's character, does refer to Lelena as a waif. So mm-hmm. You know, I don't buy that this woman is drinking 64 ounces of Coca-Cola a day. It has to be Diet Coke.
Another fun fact I read when I was looking at some information about this movie, actually, it turns out that there were no 7-Elevens in Houston at that time, so it would have been impossible to get a Big Gulp.
Whoa.
That's great.
That's really funny because you were talking last week, Sue, about how you appreciated Singles sort of like authenticity because it was set in Seattle and was filmed in Seattle, whereas Reality Bites is set in Houston and was mostly filmed in LA. And the fact that they got this wrong about the Big Gulps is kind of funny. Also, like on sort of like a kind of macro level about the movie, it's funny that this movie sort of has this message about not selling out, and yet it is jam-packed with like product placement, and they're talking about Big Gulps and Coke and
Pizza
Domino's
Hut.
Pizza. Yeah,
yes.
And, like all of these things.
Yeah, it does. And Lelena, she is pretty smitten by him, and they make out and presumably sleep together. But Troy sees them making out, and like you said, Al, I mean, it's a love triangle because they're supposed to be friends, Lelena and Troy, but clearly he's into her.
Right, right. There's a thing where Vicky decides that she needs to get an AIDS test and Leilani films it, you know, for her documentary thing. And Vicky says, you know, oh, the free clinic AIDS test, the rite of passage of our generation. And I felt like the movie in its handling of this topic sort of was trying a little too hard, you know, like that line of like, it's the rite of passage of our generation, like, no, don't say that. Like, have her just go and be scared. It's a scary thing. It's fine to include it in the movie, but like, I definitely felt like they were trying too hard and kind of missing the mark.
Yeah, I felt like they were trying to check a bunch of boxes and they did it with like no meaning. Like, she just was doing that. And I just thought, this didn't even need to be in the story. Or if it was here, it should be a big part of the story, not just like, oh, I'm going to go get an AIDS test because that's what we do in Gen X. Like, there's a couple things like that in this movie that I just thought it was in there because some executive said, well, we got to make sure we have this storyline here. It just didn't feel like it fit in.
Right. And speaking of checking off boxes, there's another character, Sam, played by Steve Zahn, who I usually like Steve Zahn. He's a fun guy. He's completely underutilized in this film. Mm-hmm. He's the gay character. And he actually winds up towards the end having, I think, quite an interesting storyline. But you meet him in the beginning. You meet him in the camcorder footage after graduation. And it's almost like you don't see him for the next hour of the film. And it seems like, you know, they had to have a gay person in the film.
Yeah, I didn't even know what his name was until you guys said his name was Sam.
Oh, I probably had to look it up, to be honest.
Yeah, I 100% had that same thought about, like, checking the box with his character. Like, here's this scary thing of this gay man coming out to his parents, and it doesn't really resonate because it's given, like, 14 seconds of screen time.
Yeah.
And if you want to tell a story about that, great, wonderful. Same as an AIDS scare. Like, that's a wonderful thing to include in a movie. But then, like, you have to treat it with the weight that it deserves. And if you're just kind of giving, like, this perfunctory nod to it, then it feels hollow because it is hollow.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. There's a theme of the film that the boomers, their generation was defined as you go to college, you have a career until you retire. And, you know, Gen X, I think, is the generation that first learned that that's not true. And, you know, if you just get a certificate from college, no, you have to actually have a skill or maybe study something that is employable. But Elena, she doesn't have any money and she's cut off from her presumably well-off parents. They talk about buying a new Infinity and this kind of stuff. And she really has no money. You know, she's fired. We mentioned before that she purposely messed up the cue cards for John Mahoney's character, probably because it sounded like she was going to get fired herself. So she left on her own terms. But she has no money and she goes through a number of ideas on how to get money. And weirdly, Vicky immediately offers her friend a job at the Gap, which is, you know, I mean, retail is tough, but based on the interviews of the places she eventually looks at, the Gap seems to be like a good job for her.
And she won't take it. She says she won't work at the Gap.
Well, also, she's pressuring Troy to take a job interview with her dad at the factory. We don't really know what they do at this factory, but whatever, it doesn't matter. But if her dad has this factory that's hiring people, why doesn't she go work for her dad? You know, like that could be a thing where she could earn some money. She definitely has this sort of like holier than thou attitude, and it doesn't make a ton of sense. I will say in the montage of her applying for jobs, I did appreciate like the rapid fire cameos of Andy Dick, Keith David, who would also be in a movie with Ben Stiller, Something About Mary, when he plays Mary's dad, and Ben Stiller's mom, Ann Mira.
Yeah.
It's always nice when Ben Stiller brings his parents in for, you know, like a cameo or two.
He didn't bring Jerry in. I was waiting for Jerry Stiller.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, in Heavyweights.
Heavyweights. He brought him in Heavyweights, absolutely.
Both of his parents were in that, right?
Yep, yeah.
Yeah, but or whatever. He just gave his mom some screen time in this one. The way that she ultimately makes money is she exploits like this one little loophole of her dad's offer, which was, I want you to take this car. And, you know, she didn't want to accept the car at first, but she was willing to take it on this condition that the dad would pay for the gas card for a year. And so every time they're hungry and they want food, they go to the gas station and grab all that they can. And that's where they have that, I guess, kind of iconic scene where they're dancing to My Sharona in the gas station. And what she ultimately does is she goes and hangs out at the gas station and like offers to people that I will pay for your gas on my card if you give me the cash. So she's making money in a quote unquote clever way, but also it's because she's got a rich dad who's basically bailing her out even though he's not handing her a check, like he's still solving the problem for her.
I assumed she was doing something a little bit shadier than that. I assumed she was saying stuff like, I'll give you $25 worth of gas, just give me $20.
Yeah, I think that's what she was doing.
Right, right. Meanwhile, Michael is trying to get Leilana's documentary on his network, and she's at first a little hesitant, but then he takes the tapes anyway, and the executives that he shows it to, they love it, and they want to put it on the network. And at first, it's kind of like, well, he shouldn't have done that because he shouldn't have taken the tapes without her permission, but she's really excited about it. And when they eventually watch the footage that this MTV-like network had and they edited it, they made it into an MTV-style show. Obviously, then Leilana's upset and she has this huge fight with Michael. I couldn't help but think, though, that Michael is in the wrong, but he was very apologetic about what happened to her footage and he was saying he didn't know about it. I don't know. Like, it's basically what ends their relationship. And it didn't seem to me like a relationship ending fight.
Well, I couldn't understand how he just got her tapes, took them to whoever his production team was and did all this stuff. And she had no involvement. Like, that part, I don't know, Alan, you maybe know how these things work better than me, but that seemed... like, wouldn't there be some contract or something involved?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, there could have been a deal where she just signed over her footage and she wouldn't have any editorial control. That's possible. Would a network like MTV do that and rip people off for their footage? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's libelous. But like, networks do that sort of thing. But Michael should have seen it. You would assume that at some point someone would have shown it to him and then he could have had a reaction to it. So maybe he was lying when he said he had no idea about it. Or I would guess someone tried to set a screening with him and he was too busy or he blew it off or whatever. And okay, that's how he saw it for the first time. Because I can't imagine that it would be in this like big setting and no one would have seen it. At one point, you do see Leilana like in an editing room with the footage, and she's kind of like playing with the tape a little bit. But like, was she editing it? We never see her doing any editing before that. So it's a small detail, but it does impact it, because if she was editing her own stuff, then yeah, she could be more pissed if they re-edited it. But if she never edited anything, then well, it's up to them to edit it and, you know, make it into a story.
I don't think Elena's footage would ever get anywhere. Not that no one would pick it up because she doesn't know anyone in the industry, but I don't think she really was pressing to make this. It seemed like she was never really getting around to it. And Michael kind of jump-started it by taking the tapes. And there's one line when Michael is saying, oh my God, I had no idea. And all right, we'll take out the Pizza Hut thing. Like, that seemed like a weird line. He's like, don't you mean we'll let you do it all? Like, he's like, all right, we'll take out the one Pizza Hut thing.
They just needed to say Pizza Hut.
Right. I bet they got 10 grand from Pizza Hut, so they had to have it there. But, you know, this is around the time that The Real World came out. And they mention in this that In Your Face TV is now going to start showing real television as opposed to, you know, what we'd eventually term reality TV. But it was a pretty good guess by them that they would be called real television. But I have to say that it really did look like a pretty accurate MTV-ification of a show.
Yeah, actually, though, a couple things struck me about that scene. One was, I think the Ben Stiller character says, we're making this for the younger generation. This is what they want. So it's kind of interesting how the movie, a lot of it is about the reaction to the generation before Gen X. But then what they're doing it to her film is actually for the next generation. They want those quick cuts and all that stuff. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
You know, but the other thing too, but my first thought when I saw that was, what are her friends going to say? Like, this is personal. Like, I couldn't understand how they were on board with this project to begin with, because there's all this personal, you know, information, like, you know, her friend going to get an AIDS test. And then here it is in this all slicked up like this, and it's going out to the world with them? Like, how did they agree to this?
They would have had to have had a release, I assume. I don't think Elena could have released their footage unless she had a release from them. That's a good point. Like, it would never really would have aired until they got everyone's consent.
Right. I mean, it's one thing to, like, be in a goofy movie that your friend is shooting on her camcorder and then, like, you know, maybe you watch it in a couple years and have some laughs or whatever, but putting it on TV is a very, very different thing. And you could imagine that in the early 90s, maybe people weren't thinking about that because, you know, the reality TV boom hadn't happened. But yeah, certainly there was going to be some fallout, you know, about Vicky's AIDS test and Sammy coming out and all of these things that are highly sensitive and personal moments that are going to be plastered on TV and then made into sound bites, basically, which is, by the way, I read what the title means, like reality bites. It's about like sound bites. And it's not meant to be like a commentary that reality sucks, which is what I had always assumed.
Okay.
Yeah. I assumed it was that too.
Yeah.
But, you know, one thing about the Reality Bites fake show they make is that I think that Troy comes across incredibly well in it. Just the way they do his headshot, I was like, Troy, you shouldn't be mad at this, because if this is released, you are going to be like America's new like heartthrob. I mean, Ethan Hawke is like, he's total like Teen Beat magazine look in this film.
Because you brought that up, James, I'll ask you this now. I mean, it seems like the movie really wants you, the audience, to root for Leilani to hook up with Troy. And like, Troy's the good choice and Michael is the bad choice. And I don't know if it's just the fact that I'm in my 40s or what, but I just didn't see Troy as the better option, like on any level. And maybe I would have felt differently if I had watched this movie in 1994, but like, what did you guys think? Were you guys team Troy, team Michael, team neither?
I had exactly the same thought. I was rooting for Michael and Elena, but I was saying, when I was watching this with my girlfriend, I was saying, I wonder if I watched this when I was like 15 years old. I bet I could see myself rooting for the couple that they want you to root for.
Yeah, I thought Troy was kind of a creep, personally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was supposed to be, I guess, a slacker, but he wasn't nearly as cool as Matt Dillon's character in Singles. I can't help it, you guys. We watched him back to back.
It's fine. You're allowed.
I just couldn't understand what his deal was. He was supposed to be super smart, but I just didn't get him. So I wasn't rooting for him. But honestly, I thought the way this movie went, in the end, Leilani, or whatever her name is, the Winona Ryder character, was really portrayed as weak, especially towards the end, where the two guys were telling her what she should do, you know, that she should be with them, and she had to decide. And it was all about how they thought she should behave. And I just got done watching Queen's Gambit. So I think that's part of the reason, too, that I was a little more critical to the story, because, you know, here's this 20-ish waif of a woman who's really smart. And, you know, the way that the character's portrayed in this particular movie, she's just so weak, and I wanted her to be more than that. So I really was angry at both the guys by the end.
Yeah, I guess let's talk about what happens at the end. Michael winds up coming back, trying to win her back, and Elena and Troy have slept together. Michael doesn't know this yet. Michael and Troy, like you said, have a huge fight with each other. Troy leaves, and we're not really sure why he leaves. And Elena, she's a little lost, and she's going back to the bars. And Troy had left because it turns out that Troy's father had died. There was a reference earlier on in the film that he had pancreatic cancer. And I actually had assumed that since the pancreatic cancer was back in college, I assumed he had died by then, but he didn't. And, you know, of course you feel terrible for Troy. His father's dead. And in this sympathetic moment, Elena, she kisses him, and basically the film ends with them getting together. And There's a slight post-credits scene. Michael does wind up making, he doesn't use the documentary Reality Bites footage, but he sort of takes a fictionalized version of it, and he casts lookalikes for Troy and Lelena. I don't know if you recognize this woman, Karen Duffy. She was an MTV VJ. I totally had a crush on her. And I noticed in the box office, this movie opened at number 5, but number 4 was a movie called Blank Check. And Karen Duffy was in that film too. So she had 2 top 5 films that weekend. And I think that was the only time she did. But yeah, then the film ends, and it ends with Lisa Loeb's stay in the closing credits.
Right, right. Well, now that we're at the end, Sue, we will ask you as our very special guest, do you think Reality Bites stands the test of time?
Well, I feel a little more qualified to answer that this week, having now done this twice in a row. And I feel like watching these two movies back to back really made me understand at least one of the ways you can decide if a movie stands the test of time. And I think the way you can decide is by asking yourself, is there a reason to watch this movie today? And I don't think there is. So, I mean, where Singles, sure, you know, the storyline with the characters may have its faults, but there's an authenticity to the place that they're living and the time they're living in and the surroundings around them, the music, and even if only to see Eddie Vedder when he was 22 is a reason to watch that. This movie, in the end, I thought the story was kind of weak. And I wondered, you know, what happened to this story? Like, supposedly this was written by a woman, but the way that they portrayed the Winona Ryder character, I think what happened here, it's like kind of meta, but I think what happened to this is that a director and a producer team got a hold of this story and completely changed it into something that's just, to me, doesn't stand up.
That is very fair.
And I think that's a fantastic way of asking, does a film stand the test of time, by the way? What do you think, Al? You had never seen this film. Do you think 1994's Reality Bites stands the test of time?
I have to agree with pretty much everything you're saying, Sue. I mean, it's a fairly trite story of this love triangle, and it's not really all that interesting. It's not surprising in any way. I mean, it's a foregone conclusion at like the 3-minute mark that Leilana is going to end up with Troy. Like, you know that going in. There's no surprises. There's nothing shocking. There's one moment at the end where like Leilana runs out after she has this fight with Michael and Troy. And, you know, then they kind of like both follow her to the street and they have like this conversation about, you don't deserve her. Well, I don't believe in love and whatever. And at that point, I was like, well, maybe the movie's going to end with she doesn't need either of them. And that would have been interesting.
Right.
But that's not what happens. She ends up with Troy. And it's one thing to sort of look at a movie as like a moment in time, but the dated references in this movie, I mean, we talked about some of them, but I mean, there's a million of them. It's like they were trying to put in like references that were hip in 1994, but wouldn't make any sense a few years later. They mentioned Richard Simmons. Okay, I guess he was around for a while. There's a line about the sexual tension between Bonnie Franklin and Schneider. I had to Google that. I had no idea who those people were. It's One Day at a Time, if anyone cared. I didn't get that. I kind of laughed at one point when they say, oh, I think Domino's takes checks. That just seemed like a very 90s thing to say. Marky Mark, Good Times, NutraSweet, the Psychic Hotline, 1-900 numbers. These are things that were very of the moment, and they don't add anything to the movie. They're just there. The fact that it's a big studio movie that has this like Gen X anti-establishment sort of thing going, like, it's a contradiction right there. It's the same way that it contradicts itself as it's being like a movie about not selling out and it's filled with product placement. You can almost sort of see how this movie could have been a very different thing if Helen Childress, the woman who wrote it, if she had maybe just made a small independent movie without the giant studio, without all of the A-list actors, and maybe that would have been a very different thing. Maybe no one would have seen it. You know, people saw it because it had Winona Ryder and Ethan Hawke and Janine Garofalo in it. But it feels like so rubber stamped and so not memorable that I'm going to agree that it does not stand the test of time. James, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to say a couple things I like in this film. I think the acting is very good in this film. Ethan Hawke is a fantastic actor now. Ben Stiller, he's a great director now. I mean, Tropic Thunder is a fantastic comedy. And yeah, he directed that, wrote it. So, you know, he hones his craft. The soundtrack is great. I think that's really nice. Basically, what you said, Alex, I think is interesting. This film could have been very good. I know what you say. Yeah, we know right away who she's going to end up with. I actually didn't. I actually had hope that this is going to be the opposite of what you thought. But even if she did end up with who you thought, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm fine with that. But Troy is a completely unlikable character. They put a couple of things they didn't even have to put in. Like, there's a part in the early in the film that he sleeps with a woman and she gives him her number and he throws it away, like, right in front of her door. Like, literally to the point where she's probably going to find that note, like, outside her door the next day. And you didn't have to include that for that character. And, you know, it's really interesting you say that Reality Bites is about sound bites, because there was sort of a slogan in the mid-90s, and in retrospect, because the mid-90s were so prosperous and so peaceful worldwide, it was just whatever, period. Like, that was a bumper sticker. Like, people were just like, blah. And, you know, like, Reality Bites, I have to say, it's a great title. I think Reality Bites is a fantastic name for a mid-90s film. I just didn't like the characters. And actually, I think you're supposed to dislike Michael, but I liked him. He's not perfect, but he means well. And, you know, I think you're supposed to dislike him more than you do. And I think you're supposed to like Troy more than I do. So for all those reasons, the film just doesn't add up. You know, it's a stepping stone of things to come. But this film, no, it does not stand the test of time.
Oh, also, in that post-credit sequence, the Troy character says, "I'm Audi 5000. Remember when people used to say that?
Yeah.
That should stay dead and buried in the 90s. Well, Sue, thank you for coming back on to talk about another movie with us, another Gen X rom-com or romantic movie or whatever you want to call it. Just thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun, even though none of us really loved the movie. That almost made it more fun.
Al, did this film make you like Singles any better? I'm wondering, if we did this film first, do you think it's possible you might say Singles stands up?
You guys know how I feel about it, but I was going to ask Ellen that question.
I don't know. I mean, I think that, it's a tough question. I don't think so. I think they both have things that I can appreciate, but I don't think I'm going to be racing to see either of these movies again. I still like the single soundtrack. I don't know. I like the Reality Bites soundtrack too. All I Want Is You by U2 is like one of my top three favorite U2 songs ever. That's just such a great song. I hate that that cover of Baby, I Love Your Way, though. Right? But anyway, Sue, thank you for coming on the show, for being with us 2 weeks in a row, and tell everyone again where they can find your podcast, Go Informed.
They can find my podcast wherever they're listening to this podcast.
There you go.
You can also find my website at goinformed.net, and I'm on all the social media places. Just look for Go Informed Net.
And don't go on a vacation without checking out the site, the blog, the social media, everything. If you're going to Disney World, if you're thinking about maybe going to Disney World when this pandemic is over, check out Go Informed. It is amazing. Thank you again, Sue, and we'll have to have you back on sometime. It could be Seattle-based, Gen X-based, or have absolutely nothing to do with any of those things.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is great.
It's been really fun. Thanks for having me on.
That's going to do it for us this week. Next week, we're going to be talking about A Time to Kill. I haven't seen that one, but that's a legal thriller with Samuel L. Jackson, I believe.
Matthew McConaughey, Sandra Bullock's in it as well. It's based on the novel by John Grisham, so the novel was fantastic. And, you know, novel adaptations in the movies can go either way. So, you know, we'll definitely see how that goes. And I haven't seen this film in years.
Don't miss that episode. Don't miss any episode. Just subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, whatever platform you like best. Subscribe to Go Informed while you're there. And talk to us. We are at Tested Time Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. See you next week, everybody.
Bye.
And we are Audi 5000.